Translation. Here also are Govinda Ghosh, Madhava Ghosh, and Vasudev Ghosh. They are three brothers, and their Sankirtan, congregational chanting, pleases the Lord very much. Please. Govinda Ghosh belonged to the Kayastha dynasty of the Uttara Radhiya section, and he was known as Ghosh Thakur. Even to the present day, there is a place named Agradweep near Katwa, where a fair takes place and is named after Ghosh Thakur. As far as Vasudev Ghosh is concerned, he composed many nice songs about Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and these are all authorized Vaishnav songs, like the songs of Narottam Das Thakur, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Lochan Das Thakur, Govinda Das Thakur, and other great Vaishnavas. I'm nervous. So, there was a couple of things I wanted to, two main points I'd like to speak about. One was actually related to, because yesterday Chaitanya Charanprabhu's wonderful class gave us a sense of the mood of this chapter building up towards Rathiyatra, the idea of the, essentially the kind of the rasa moods which are leading to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's ecstasy in the pastimes of Rathiyatra. This chapter is called Bhedi Kirtan, so in terms of these aspects that Prabhu spoke about, he mentioned this idea that Chaitanya Charitamrita is essentially theology in the form of a biography. And quite an interesting point, because most of our scriptures, like the narratives which, you know, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, for example, story after story, same with CC, of course, Ramayana, Mahabharata, etc., that narratives are clearly a very important way for us to understand philosophy. And the examples of the stories of the devotees are as prominent, sometimes even more prominent than the stories of the Lord himself. So this list of devotees gives us a certain insight, because with the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it's very much that we can, when we go to Mayapur, we can kind of almost very closely imagine what it was like during Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's time, during the pastimes of his associates, as opposed to, of course, previous Vedic ages, which are harder to relate to our current experience. So that's kind of has a very powerful kind of role for us. And in here, the scene is set with Ramananda Rai, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, and Gopinath Acharya, because remember the build-up to this, as we've been reading in this chapter so far, is that Ramananda Rai really is desperate to meet Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, right? So we've kind of heard about that. And all of these steps are building up to his, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is showing through his devotees this point about what is it that qualifies us to meet with the Lord. And there are very different aspects to, several different aspects to this in the build up to it. And as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has already said to Ramananda, Ramananda Rai? I meant King Prataparudra, of course. He already said to Ramananda Rai that because Ramananda Rai had spoken highly of King Prataparudra, and because the king had offered service to Ramananda Rai, therefore Krishna would surely bless him. So this is all kind of building up to this point. And now King Prataparudra, he knows that the devotees of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu from Bengal are coming to associate with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu after this much separation, and he's very eager to see them. So this is another kind of very profound qualification for us to receive the mercy of the Lord, is the enthusiasm and kind of commitment to appreciate the devotees. And Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya says essentially, well, I don't know them because they're from Bengal, but Gopinath Acharya, who's Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya's brother-in-law, he knows them because he's from there, so he knows all these devotees who's coming, and he can name them, he can point them out to you. So they go up, and then, of course, we heard the list of devotees being mentioned, and many of the devotees are, obviously, we, you know, like there's chapters dedicated to their glories in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Chaitanya Bhagavat, etc. So I won't go through the whole list because that will take days and days. Just to point out that some of the devotees are mentioned later, like very specifically. So for example, Ganga Das Pandit is mentioned. He's the personality whom Chaitanya Mahaprabhu studied grammar under. Then Shankara Pandit is mentioned. Shankara Pandit is actually Shiva Pandit's brother, younger brother. And his story is told about how he was became famous as the pillow of Lord Chaitanya. So during the pastimes of Gambhira, when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would rub his face against the walls, like, and he would, you know, like, the devotees, and especially Swarup Damodar, would become so distressed at this expressions of ecstasy that they were trying to figure out, how do we, you know, prevent Chaitanya Mahaprabhu from doing this? So they allowed Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, they convinced Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to allow Shankara Pandit to stay with him. So he would keep Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's feet on his lap, massage him. That's why he was known as the pillow of Lord Chaitanya. And it's even said that because sometimes he would fall asleep through the night because he would be massaging, that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would wake up, take his own shawl, chadar, and place it on Shankara Pandit. So these stories about these personalities bring out the very intimate, personal relationships that the Lord has with his devotees. And that's why we are so essentially encouraged to hear about them, because they're the it's the mood with which we aspire to serve the Lord. So Nisimananda Brahmachari is another one who's mentioned, of course. Again, I'm sure you all know the story about how he, in his mind, created the road for Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to go to Vrindavan, and he understood that he would stop before getting to Vrindavan and told the devotees. So I won't speak so much about them, mainly because their stories are told in other parts of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. but what I wanted to just reflect on here is that if you think about, like, the scene and the mood that's been created by Kaviraj Goswami, like, when we hear these names and we hear their glories and we know they're, like, it's kind of like a all-star cast, right? It's like the who's who of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's associates are all here. And I was thinking that, like, that is also, it's a tendency of the soul. Like, it's a tendency of all of us. And you see it reflected in the material world, where people gravitate towards that type of thing, where they like the idea of seeing, hearing, speaking to, associating with what in their perception are great personalities, famous personalities, personalities who are known for something. And that the principle is similar. The principle is that the soul has that because we see something of Krishna's opulence reflected. And in the spiritual dimension, of course, Krishna's opulences are reflected to the devotees. His personality, the devotees reflect his opulences. So there is something intrinsically, deeply attractive about that. And either we become attracted to that, or we become attracted to something else. The attraction is going to happen, as we know, that we're going to be attracted by something. And therefore, the list of these personalities, their glories are attractive, because they're there to attract us. How wonderful these devotees were, what type of personalities they had, what kind of exchanges they had with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, to essentially attract us, just as in the same way that the pastimes and the characteristics of the Lord are there to attract us. So, and they kind of like represent these archetypes. And even, I was thinking that even so many of our bhajans are actually names of devotees. Like, if you take like Gaura Arati, or, you know, the Jaya Radha Jaya Krishna, like, there's so many of our songs are about the devotees. They reflect that. They mention their pastimes and their glories. And I felt that there's a very specific thing that our tradition has about, you know, has to say about personalism. So generally we talk about it from the quite a high level that, you know, we believe God is a person, and that's kind of like, and we might get to rasa. But there are these nuances, these particularities of our tradition about personalism are very deep. And that's why the first point I really wanted to bring up was a point that Govinda Prabhu, you asked this question yesterday about panentheism. I was listening online. I was kind of like jumping up a bit down because, but luckily Chaitanya Charanprabhu came home last night because there was a Panasena program. And I had the good fortune to speak to him a little bit about this. And I asked him if I could just expand upon the answer a little bit, because for those of you who weren't here at yesterday's class, Govinda Prabhu asked a question that can devotees describe themselves as panentheists? Is that a fair reflection of the question? And so panentheism, as distinguished from pantheism, so pantheism, as we know, is that the equivalence of God and nature, that's the idea, right? So God and nature are exactly the same, they're identical. And panentheism is one step removed, which is essentially that God and nature, so God is nature, but he's also beyond nature. And it's obviously a Greek term, comes from that philosophy. And there is, it's somehow or another, there is rising, and it's kind of like it's becoming more known. People are speaking about it. I've heard it spoken about in a couple of different contexts, read about it in a couple of different contexts. And interestingly, it came up just the other week. We had there's a professor from the Cambridge University Divinity Faculty who did a retreat, a residential for some of our A-level students at Avanti. And he was speaking about panentheism, and he mentioned it in the context of he knows the tradition very well. He occupies the same post that Julius Lipner did, who was Tamal Krishna Maharaj's PhD supervisor. And he mentioned it, and I probed it a little bit because there was something there which didn't quite sit right with me, and interestingly, I then read something in the Brahma Samhita, which I'd like to share with you. This is a quote by, well, it's part of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's foreword to the Brahma Samhita. So in there he says, "A very close attention and a comparative study of all prevailing thoughts and conceptions will relieve and enlighten all. Be he a materialist, a downright atheist, an agnostic, a skeptic, a naturalist, a pantheist, or a panentheist, busy with their knowledge of three dimensions only by their speculative assertions." So, as we know, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was very precise and very penetrating in his analysis and protection. Rupanuga viruddhapa siddhanta dvanta harine is his pranam, one of his lines of his pranam, siddhanta dvanta, like this idea that of protecting the line, the philosophical tradition of Rupa Goswami. Very penetrating and very powerful, really, in his protection of our siddhanta. So here he's making this point that he's grouping these people together. The materialist, atheist, agnostic, skeptic, naturalist, pantheist, panentheist. So when I read that, I also felt that we have to be a little bit careful in terms of how we use this term, because it has certain connotations in the philosophy that it was brought from. And the interesting point here is Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is making this point about how these are speculative ideas. So you can get to the point of pantheism, panentheism through like a speculative jnani style approach. And interestingly, he's saying this in the context of Brahma Samhita, which is also very, very relevant, because the Brahma Samhita, he makes the point elsewhere in the foreword, goes beyond any type of speculation. Like, there's no need to speculate about the spiritual world. Here it is. Here are the intricate details of this and descriptions of the spiritual world, which takes us beyond any type of speculation. And therefore, this notion that whilst we may gravitate towards terms like panentheism, because they do reflect some aspect of our philosophy, that we understand that Krishna is manifest through the natural world and that he is transcendent to it. So he's immanent and transcendent. So we get that. But whether we should go around wholesale carte blanche describing ourselves as panentheists, that we need to be careful about, because as we can see, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is not associating ourselves with that idea. We have to. So what I wanted to really kind of say here is that we have to, as Srila Prabhupada did, you know, when he used the term Krishnaite, like this term that he, like, we have to define our theology, our philosophy on our own terms. And there was a, I saw a Kandidi Prabhu was on a online debate with an atheist, and I forget, but this atheist was pushing Akhandadi Prabhu on philosophy, and he was trying to, so Akhandadi Prabhu was describing Brahman and this idea of how Brahman is a transformation and in terms of the material world. So this atheist was like, look, either it's idealism or it's dualism or it's non-dualism. Which one is it? Like, you know, and Akhandadi Prabhu was like, you could see, like, he was resisting that. It wasn't the form making it to the full detail because the subject matter was slightly different. But it like, I thought, we have to resist that, like, because Western philosophy, Western civilization has been bought out of Roman Greece in terms of the traditions. And there is, Christianity obviously borrows heavily from Greek philosophy. So there is a natural kind of tendency to bucket ourselves into these categories because that's what the Western world is built on. And we do it often for good reason, because we're trying to connect with the person because that's what they understand. And so we're trying to position ourselves in language and terms that they understand because we're trying to bridge to them, right? That's one of the main reasons why we do these things. But in that process, and that's the challenge for us, that how do we explain the nuances and depths of our philosophy without compromising its integrity? And that's the role of the preacher. That's the role of and the challenge really for us. And it's something that struck me when, like, I was thinking about this, this section and about these names of all of these great personalities who are relatively unknown in the Western world. But obviously for us to be able to position our theology, our philosophy, and our heroes, like, you know, these are the personalities that we look up to, these are the personalities that we seek to emulate and follow in their footsteps because of these reasons. And that requires us to really kind of preserve that integrity. So so that was the maybe I'll just say one more because I realize I've got a little bit of time. What I've studied, three main things, like, so I did, my undergrad was science related, so mainly chemistry. I did an MBA, so I did leadership management, and I've been studying a lot of philosophy recently. And when I finished my MBA, the one thing that really, like, landed with me very strongly was, so it was at London Business School, one of the best schools in the world, 2-year degree. And the thing that landed with me was, like, Srila Prabhupada knows more than all of this. Like, if you really want to learn about leadership and management, you can get it much better from Srila Prabhupada's example and his books. And then I was thinking about, like, science. And I was thinking, the things that Srila Prabhupada's saying in his books are more scientific than the things that I learned in my degree, which are now being revised in light of recent understandings about science. And then when I read philosophy, and you think, all of these philosophers over hundreds of years, like, all of their points have already been addressed by our acharyas and Srila Prabhupada's purports. So there is a need, I feel, that sometimes we can see something outside of our tradition and think that it has something new or something progressive or something to add. And sometimes it's because we may not know the depths of our tradition well enough to be able to understand how our acharyas have already addressed these issues. 100 years ago, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was talking about panentheism, and we're talking about it now. Like, he's already dealt with the issue. So that was one main point. Sorry, I know it was to do with yesterday's, but I thought it was I feel quite strongly about this, just in terms of how we take our movement, our philosophy, our preaching forward, particularly when it comes to reaching out to audiences that are not familiar with Hinduism broadly. Then how do we frame it and how do we offer it and position it in such a way that, yes, we want to reach them on their terms, but we also don't want to compromise our integrity in doing so. Okay, so maybe I can just pause there. If there are any comments or questions or things that like we want to explore before I go into the second part, which is the purport to this particular verse. Anybody? Yeah.
Isn't there also... Okay. Isn't there also the consideration that, for example, leadership and management, like the secular world have explored our teachings more than we have in relation to things like that? Like, I was thinking, like, SWOT analysis, it corresponds to, like, Abhideya in one sense.
Jai Shri Shri Radha Gokula Nanda ki jai, Shri Shri Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman ki jai, Shri Shri Gonitai ki jai. SWOT analysis,
like, corresponds to Abhideya, Sambandha, because you're kind of looking at, you know, what's the kind of dynamics that you're dealing with.
Yeah, I mean, in one sense, like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says in the CC, there is nothing in the Vedic scriptures beyond Sambandha, Abhideya, Prayojana. So, like, you can group all of these things, however, you know, you can categorize everything within these three things. I mean, it's speaking to an underlying truth, right? Like, whether we go through this direction or that direction, there's truth there. Yes, bro.
Okay. In Western philosophy, usually the time is very linear. That's how the consideration is. Mm-hmm. Whereas in our case, the time is circular. Mm-hmm. And if in that perspective, if we see, then the personality is appearing in different lila.
Yeah, I mean, this is another point about how we present our philosophy, because in science, for example, there's this idea that if you have a theory, it has to be predictive. You have to be able to use a theory to predict an outcome that you wouldn't otherwise be able to do, right? Like, so that's a kind of a concept. In our tradition, what's happened, I mean, coming back to the point about, you know, SWOT analysis, like, the point is that, okay, if we had taken Sambandha Abhideya or Abhideya just by itself and created a SWOT analysis, that would be different. But when somebody's created a SWOT analysis and we go back and try and claim it as our own, then it's a bit problematic. It's like, well, then you're just reading backwards, right? So for example, like with time, like our scriptures are full of examples of the relativity of time, isn't it? So many stories, King Indradyumna, Brahma, so many stories of time being relative. But guess what? Somebody else discovered it. His name was Einstein, right? So had we been able to predict the point of, based on our scriptures, looking out rather than reading back, which is what we're doing now, that, hey, we already talked about relativity. It's too late. So, you know, like, that's the point that, okay, we can take these things and we can look forward. So that's this idea of cyclical time. How do we use these insights, which are unique, as you say, like to the Dharmic traditions, like how do we use the principle of cyclical time to look forward, as in to predict outwards? And many people are, you know, so that's what I mean about knowing the depths of our philosophy, to be able to position it and explain it in a way that somebody else can understand its relevance. So you can talk about cyclical time, the concept we already know, like actually the natural experience of our life. You know, even something as basic as the seasons, like being so intricately linked with ancient traditions about being in sync with cyclical time, But it's been lost. Yeah, but our, like, how do we relate cyclical time? See, ultimately, like, you could just take a scriptural thing. Our scripture says that, your scripture takes that. I mean, and then, you know, that's it. Like, let's leave it there. Or we can explain why we think cyclical time is a reasonable, rational, experiential thing, that we experience it. We see it in the universe. We see it in the form of the universe expanding and contracting. We see it in these different elements. And therefore, that's why we think it's like that. And, you know, the idea even simply of energy being transformed in different ways and not being lost. Okay, anything? Yes. Let's see.
Can you explain what's the difference between our
So our philosophy is, this is why I think the point that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is making is that in the Brahma Samhita, we're going beyond, the scripture goes beyond all speculations. And he's categorizing panentheism, like here he's saying, let's see what he says. He says that busy with their knowledge of three dimensions only by their speculative assertions. Like these positions, the positions of the materialist, the atheist, the agnostic, skeptic, naturalist, pantheist, panentheist, these positions, philosophical positions, are arrived at through speculation. And it's interesting he uses the word three dimensions. Now, whether he means three dimensions in terms of mathematical terms or the three gunas, I'm not sure, but both could apply. Like, that's the remit, that's the boundary of their thinking. So what we don't want to, it's not to say that there isn't an element of panentheism which could be applied to our philosophy that we could relate to. But to wholesale adopt the term as a full description of our philosophy is just not accurate. Because panentheism in itself essentially means God is nature, nature is God, kind of, and then there's transcendent God. So that's all it, and but from there, like, so for example, the most well-known strand of panentheism is process theology by the guy who co-wrote the book with Bertrand Russell, Principia Mathematica. So like that theology essentially is God, so God is nature. Nature is like there's a relationship between nature and God. God influences nature, and nature influences God. So God is transformed. Now, if you think about it, I mean, that's completely contradictory to our philosophy. But that is probably the most famous strand of panentheism, which is why I'm saying that we have to be cautious when using these types of terms because they have other connotations or implications. It's okay. So, yeah.
Probably just going back to Prayer Bhaktivinoda's question, what were you saying about, you know, we have these concepts in our scriptures, like circular time. Then you mentioned how if someone did a SWOT analysis of it.
No. No, he mentioned SWOT being founded in Abhideya. Connected to Abhideya.
So, but what's our approach like in terms of, let's say, Western modern scholars demonstrate certain concepts which align with our philosophy?
Oh.
But is it that we don't, just because it aligns with our philosophy, we don't kowtow to that, oh, look, see, we've had this before. Is that because it's giving them unnecessary strength, whereas we shouldn't be dependent on their validation or something? Is that.
Yeah, yeah. No, so. There's no problem if there is something genuine that's, and like I said, all of these things are trying to aim at truth. science, philosophy, whatever, right? So they're all trying to get to truth. And therefore, because the Vedic scriptures speak about underlying fundamental truth, clearly there's going to be some connection, hopefully. So there's no issue about us referencing something that is said, and we use that as a support argument for what we're trying to say. There's no problem with that. I'm just saying two things. One is, it is more powerful in our presentation of our philosophy if we make the prediction rather than reading back in time based on somebody else's prediction. So that's one thing I'm saying. And I gave the example of the time, relativity of time. From our scriptures, we can predict the relativity. Like we can make the point strongly about the time being relative. At a certain point in time, sorry for the pun, but like, at a certain point, that would not have been appreciated, right? Pre-Einstein. But we could have done that. So that's one point. The second point is that if and when we take philosophical concepts from outside, we have to take them with real caution. And we have to apply them only to the degree that they fit with the parameters of our philosophy, not wholesale. Because they come from, typically, they come from a speculative position, they carry a whole bunch of baggage with it, which we may not even be aware of. Just like I was giving the example just now about like the main strand or the one of the most famous strands of panentheism. So panentheism on the surface, it may seem like, sounds great, describes us, let's go with it. But there's other stuff that we need to be careful about. Okay, are we done with that section? All right, so this verse then coming, there is some connection, hopefully I'll be able to draw it out. So these three personalities who are mentioned in this particular verse now, so Madhava, the three brothers, Madhava, Vasudeva, and Govinda Ghosh. So these were wonderful, amazing singers, as the verse describes. Even Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would get so much pleasure from hearing them sing. And it said that when Vasudeva Ghosh would sing, that even when he would sing about the glories of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Lord Nityananda, even wood and stone would melt. That was the kind of description. And then Srila Prabhupada references Govinda Ghosh and the place from where he was, Agradweep. And I found this very wonderful story, which I thought brings us back to this point about, and this is the connection, that it brings us back to this point of how deep the personal, our philosophical and theological understanding of personalism is in our tradition, and therefore why we need to protect that from other competing ideas. So once Govinda Ghosh was bathing in the Ganga, and as he was bathing, an object touched him on the back, and it was floating, so he thought it was wood, but it was also stone. So it was floating stone. So he couldn't understand it. So, but that night he had a dream that you keep this material, this object, and tell Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And so he's told him to. So next day Chaitanya Mahaprabhu comes, and he says, and Govinda Ghosh brings this object, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, now you don't need to worry. A sculptor will come and he'll carve a deity, because Govinda Ghosh Prabhu was having this notion of like worshipping Krishna. So then the sculptor comes, he understands this is actually a Shila, and from the Shila, Krishna's deity is going to become manifest. This deity is now called Gopinath. And later, on the inspiration of the Lord, Govinda Ghosh marries and he has a son. And his son and his wife die one after the other. And he's so distraught that he stops his worship of the deity. And then the deity comes in his dream, and the deity says, Gopinath says to Govinda Ghosh, that is it right? Do you think it's right that because somebody, one person, their son has died, that they should starve their other son? So, as So you think that the story would end there, but actually he replies to Gopinath, and he said, look, I had a son, and my aspiration was that my son would fulfill the ritual objectives, the offering of pind, the shraddh ceremony, and in that way he would fill these obligations out. What am I going to get from worshipping you? At least this son would have fulfilled all of these obligations for me. What benefit will I get from worshipping you? So Gopinath says, okay, so from now, I will promise to take care of your shraddh ceremony. When you depart, I will do the shraddh and the pind offering for you and and even today, in that deity in Agradhu, which Govinda Ghosh established, during the shraddh period, they put kusha grass on the fingers of the deity, and it's considered that he's offering the shraddh on Govinda Ghosh's behalf. So these are, and we have so many stories, pastimes like this in our tradition, where the devotee is so intimately connected with the Lord, and the Lord is so intimately connected with the devotee. It's not just a one-way dynamic. And these pastimes bring out such a depth of relationship and rasa that is really, truly, I believe, unique to our tradition, in that what our tradition has to offer the world. And that's why I'm quite conscious that my first point, which I won't go over again. But this... Sorry, what's the timing on? Okay. So I'll just speak for 2-3 minutes, and then if anybody would like, again. So... Like, one of the things that strikes me about this pastime, and there are many other pastimes like this which reflect the same idea, like Dhruva Maharaj is another really prominent example in my mind, where the devotee is so, like, open and honest with the Lord. Like, there is such a depth of free-flowing, unrestricted conversation. Just like when Dhruva Maharaj is speaking to Narada Muni, the one that kind of just jumps into my mind is where he says, you know, everything you're saying is nice, all well and good, because Narada Muni is kind of testing him, like teaching him philosophy, and he's like, it's all well and good, but it doesn't sit in my heart. I still want this. So, like, there's a... And from that honesty, from that sincerity of purpose, comes everything, really. Like, if when we boil down all the intricacies and the technicalities and the formularies and all of that stuff, when we boil it all down, ultimately, we come to... Am I sincerely reaching out to the Lord? And if we sincerely do that, then everything else is kind of... So that honesty does so many amazing things. It keeps us honest in the sense of just the literal sense, but it also prevents us from kind of falling down, like, from our spiritual platform, because we're aware, like, we understand, we know... and we recognize, we don't just kind of like repress or deny or shove under the carpet stuff. And this is like the point that how it, you know, like when, because if we do that, the risk of doing that is that it just leads to, as Krishna says, what does repression accomplish? Because ultimately, you know, that verse that always has confused me a couple of times when I read it, when Krishna says, it's better to do your own, duty imperfectly, sorry, I'm paraphrasing, I don't remember the rather than somebody else's duty perfectly. And I thought, like, how could that be? Like, if you're doing it perfectly, what's the problem? How could, like, why would you not, you know, what's the... So, and it took me a little while for the penny to drop, that this idea is that you may appear to be doing it perfectly, and you may even do it perfectly, but it will be for a finite period of time, because the platform that you're standing on is not secure. Therefore, the consequences of that action, which is why it's better to do your duty, i.e. the platform that you're on, imperfectly, because at least the platform is secure. Not just for your own benefit, but for the benefit of society. If you start doing stuff that you are not, like, as you know, Krishna defines varna by guna and karma, that this, like, if that's not what your intended purpose to do, then it will cause disruption. It will cause an imbalance and a kind of chaos situation. And that's why Krishna consciousness in that regard is a long-term solution for everyone, because it can accommodate for everyone. It can accommodate for all of these varieties, and it can accommodate for people wherever they're at in terms of their own journey in their spiritual life. And that's why the connection to this purport that Srila Prabhupada has here is that he speaks about the Kayasta. He's saying that they're from the Kayasta community. Now, it's really interesting because the Kayasta community, this is the same community which we hear about Raghunath Das Goswami's family being from. And if you remember, Raghunath Das Goswami's family was from an extremely, like billionaire, kind of today's equivalent, extremely wealthy family. Now, Kayastas, so there were Kayastas who came from northern India, and they were essentially clerical or secretarial workers. So they were classified in some regions of India, like Shudras would be classified, assistant, secretarial, etc. But in Bengal, they're classified almost like Brahmanas, because they came from a very noble Kshatriya type lineage. So they're administrators, like senior level administrators. So what was interesting is that Srila Prabhupada elsewhere also comments that the Kayastas are essentially a mix of Varna. And they are regarded in different areas by this reflection of these different mix. And I thought, like, that's a really interesting point, because, like, when we think about, like, I mean, I deal with a lot of students who are thinking about careers, but even with devotees who are in careers, like, there's not, it's not clear for most people, I think, in terms of, okay, where do I fit in society? Like, with regards to Varna, with regards to Guna, what am I supposed to be doing? What should be my offering to Krishna, et cetera, et cetera. And these are long-term considerations, which we struggle with, I feel, because obviously society doesn't have the infrastructure, it's not built to reflect Varnashram. But secondly, because most of us actually are quite mixed. We have like these different conflicting natures within us that don't put us into these clear archetypes of the four Varnas, like the Kayasa community, which has a mix. And we're trying to kind of, now the third complication, I guess, for this is that we're a preaching movement. So ultimately, who cares about Varna at one level, right? Like, so we're not. So that's not an absolute consideration for us, but we know, I mean, Srila Prabhupada himself said it in terms of the 50% of work left outstanding was this establishment of Varnashram, and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur also spoke about Devi Varnashram. So like this idea that to situate ourselves on a platform where we are best placed to offer our service to Krishna in a way that has this real deep sense of honesty and also integrity. Like sometimes when these Varnas are mixed and we're acting on a platform that's not ours, our integrity is compromised, and we're not able to function as that role requires us to function, and we end up compromising, and therefore that's why Krishna is saying that's the implication for society, hence to do our own duty. Like so many kind of, and we didn't even get into the specific narrations of all of these different devotees, which I'm sure will come up in different readings of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. So I'll stop there just because it has been an hour, and I'm just conscious that you all may have comments that you'd like to contribute. Anything? Otherwise, yes, bro.
That's quite
fascinating. Sorry, I didn't hear that. Could you repeat that, please?
The core honesty.
Expression
with the Lord. I found it even more fascinating in the pastimes with Bali Maharaj.
Right.
He just says everything upfrontly.
Yeah.
And then Lord reciprocates accordingly. So that's a part of...
Yeah, yeah. It's there, like in, as you say, you know, like I think we could all think of a story where, where this is so important. Thank you. Oh, there's one point here.
Thank you for the lecture. One point you made, obviously, like with the Gita, like it's better to do your duty imperfectly rather than doing someone else's duty perfectly, because it could lead to disruption. So would you say, you know, with Bhishma, how he decided to be like not marry, do you think is a good example of that? Kurt, I was just wondering, now that you, since you brought it up. Because it did lead to a war. So.
Yeah, except that war was one that Krishna wanted, as opposed to the disruptions we cause, which Krishna may not have, may not want. I think with these types of things, with these personalities, it's like Mahajans, like Bhishma, Dev, it's better not to impose our judgments on them in the way that we should do upon ourselves, because they are part of Krishna's pastimes. And Krishna is inspiring them to act in certain ways. So whereas with us, the gunas are pushing us, and with Krishna's associates, his internal energy is pushing. So like, whereas externally it may appear that Arjuna is confused or he's not behaving like a spiritually informed person, and Krishna even chastises him, like these things may happen, but we shouldn't take the position that, oh, Arjuna is, you know what I mean? Like there's our position, and then there's like what the pastime is showing us. So we just have to be mindful of that. So yeah, I wouldn't want to use Krishna as an example, but I know what you're, yeah. You can take the principle from the story, but don't make a judgment on the personality.
Thank you.
Yes, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna, thank you. In regard of, you mentioned pastimes, so Govinda Ghosh, deities, that are very interesting how the devotees are supposed to be transcendental through all these rituals. It's interesting that he was so attached to it that even Krishna decided to maintain that. Why is that fear? It's interesting how he's in the core of that heart. Maybe for Indians it's different. For me, I don't care less for that. those rituals depend on Krishna. He was associated with Lord Chaitanya. Interesting. I mean, I guess maybe Krishna wanted to set up the example that this ritual should be maintained, because we don't discourage for those who are really attached. But devotees themselves, why they would care less about that?
Again, the same principle, Prabhu, just in terms of, like, what is the? We can see the whether this is Krishna's mercy or whether this is some deficiency. We can see by the response. So in this instance, what seems like an attachment in Govinda Ghosh is causing Krishna himself to have this argument with him, isn't it? So our deficiencies, our own limitations, don't cause Krishna to do that. There's not a deity standing there who's prepared to do my Shraddha ceremony. Like, you know, and in different stories, like you can see with Shiva's, like when his sons passed away during Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's kirtan, and he goes in the back and he says, why, because the ladies and the mother was upset and the boy was lying there. And he said, why is everybody upset? And they said, he's passed away. And he's like, you're going to disturb the kirtan. Like, sort it out. So it's not the qualification. In one regard, you can see the qualification of the personality in that instance. That qualification is very obvious, because he's saying, forget all this, just worry about the kirtan and don't upset Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, right? So then that qualification in our eyes is very clear, obvious, black and white. In Govinda Ghosh's context, his qualification is not so obvious because the first thing that we think of is that, why are you so attached? But his qualification is manifest in the fact that Krishna comes to him in the dream and says, I'm your son. Is it right that you should, because one son died, you want to starve your other son? So like Krishna is, all himself is coming to this devotee, placing himself in the position of his son, even obliging to take on the responsibilities of the son of performing Shraddha. So like that's his qualification. Now that may need us to just see the pastime from a different, like one level down, as opposed to just what's on the surface, that okay, he's attached. He's not attached. Clearly, he's not attached. If Krishna is coming to him, who does Krishna come to in that way? He doesn't come to people who are materially attached. Like, not in that. You know, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu doesn't, dance at the singing of every mundane person. He wouldn't even go to the home of somebody to take prasadam unless the person was chanting a certain number of rounds, right? Like, so this is his qualification. So we have to see them in the context of who they are. How does Krishna reciprocate with them? Because how Krishna reciprocates with that personality, we can see how elevated that person is, ultimately. Is that okay?
So many levels to this.
So like, many, yeah.
Like, you know, Krishna also could appear and explain philosophically, practically about, you know, this attachment. He could do so many things. But he decided to do that way.
It's very hard to even understand,
it's so deep that...
But isn't that the very thing that you said, like, isn't it so interesting that there is the philosophical depth of our tradition, which is beyond compare. But even beyond the philosophy, which is so deep and profound, is the relationship that Krishna has with his devotee. So yes, Krishna could have come and spoken philosophy to Govinda Ghosh, but clearly he didn't need philosophy. He knows the philosophy, so he didn't need to hear it. Krishna wanted to establish this principle of his care for his devotee. And no matter what his devotee does, Krishna loves that devotee. So there's something even, like, philosophy will take us to some point. After that point, we go beyond philosophy, isn't it? Okay, I think maybe one last question and we'll stop.
Hare Krishna. Sorry.
I'll be in trouble.
I understand what you're saying, that we shouldn't jump to label ourselves under a category so that we can be understood by other traditions or kind of put into a particular box necessarily if it doesn't fit with the integrity of our philosophy. However, I've heard this term coined a couple of times, and is that fair to say that is our philosophy? So I've heard us as being described as polymorphic by monotheists, by both Chaitanya Charan Prabhu and Garuda Prabhu. Is that a fair explanation for somebody who's trying to understand our philosophy?
Okay, so this term, polymorphic monotheism, was coined...
By monotheism.
No. So polymorphic monotheism was coined by Julius Limner, who was the professor at Cambridge, Tamal Krishna Maharaj's supervisor. Garuda Prabhu, I think, developed that into polymorphic bi-monotheism to reflect Radha and Krishna. And these terms are not existing terms. They were created. So Julius Lipner created that term to categorize or to reflect the nuance of the Vaishnav Hindu tradition, in the sense that Krishna comes in many different forms, but it's one God. And then Garuda Prabhu is adding to that. So there is a the point I'm making is that there is a difference when a term is created by somebody in knowledge to reflect our tradition, compared to taking in a term which is thousands of years old that has an existing meaning and is used in different ways by different people, and we are adopting it. That's a fundamental difference. And then that's one point. And then the second point is that even when we use those terms, polymorphic, bi-monotheism, somebody tomorrow can come, just like Garuda Prabhu built on Julius Lipner's thing, he made his thing, somebody else tomorrow could come and say something else, right? It's possible. So these things are not, they are not fundamental in the way that our scriptures are fundamental. So I'm saying that when we connect with something like this, we can connect with it in the sense that it's helpful in explaining our position, but we don't necessarily elevate it to the status of a scriptural sutra or a scriptural statement in the way that we would if, for example, Srila Prabhupada or one of our acharyas did that in the same way. Like, because we could see a clear connection. And that's why I think, you know, I'll give you an example. Like panentheism. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur clearly knew about this term 100 years ago, right? That's obvious. He's written about it 100 years ago. If he knew about that term 100 years ago, why didn't he just say it? Why didn't he just say, we're panentheists? He didn't do it because he's not categorizing us in that way, because he knows that there's a limitation to that term. So that's all I'm saying, that one is what we have, borrowing from other people, the other is creating our own, and there's a difference.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful. But then for our own understanding, how do we, even if we don't use any of these terms, what would be a simple phrase that we could use to explain to somebody who's new what our philosophy is? In terms of, I understand it's not a sutra, it's not like scripture, you know, this is just something to assist understanding. I get that point. But my question is, what would I say to somebody who comes along and says, so what's your philosophy?
I think that this is the challenge for the preacher. Like, this is our challenge. Like, this is why I don't think it is straightforward, because this is why, otherwise we would have got there already, in terms of how do we reach, particularly, this is a relevant for those people who are outside of the kind of Indian, Hindu, whatever background, because they're unfamiliar, and we're trying to frame things in terminology that they can connect with. But I just don't think that it needs to be as straightforward. No, not straightforward. I don't think it needs to be as black and white as that, because ultimately when we're explaining to different, like if I'm explaining to students versus explaining it to academics or to corporate people or whatever, or, you know, like my explanation of our philosophy is going to be different. Like how I position that to that person is going to be different. And so why do we need to have just a phrase that we all have to agree on, which explains Krishna consciousness for all time, for all people? Why does it have to be that? Like the person who's preaching should, you know, we, as I was saying, like if we understand our tradition and philosophy, then when we are speaking it to people, we'll phrase it in the way that they can understand, but that reflects the depth of our tradition without having to compromise it. And isn't that the role of the preacher in every interaction, whether it's an individual or a thousand people or whatever it is how do we convey our tradition to that person on terms that they can understand and appreciate and engage with? And I just don't think that having a single phrase is necessarily the answer for old people all time. Okay, with that, so I can't say no because it's Parojan Prabhu, so he'd maybe just like say something and then we can close. Prabhu, if we can just pass him the mic. Thank you.
I just wanted to say, referring to the Bhagavad Gita chapter 17, the divisions of faith. It's very interesting because it covers all the faiths in their differences in accordance with the modes of material nature and their time place, circumstance, whatever happens. But this is where Prabhupada brings it all together in our faith. That chapter 17 resolves everything. So if you want to know what's happening in goods, like for instance, you know, these terrorists, they're in ignorance, passion, they're killing other people. And then they laugh. They hate them.
Yeah.
It's personal. They'll commit suicide. You know, so this divisions of faith, it talks about all the circumstances, and whether it be a Jew, a Christian, or whatever, or in Krishna consciousness, there's this, we have to regard it in terms of the modes of material nature.
Yeah. Thank you, Prajna Prabhu. That's a really, really important point. I mean, it's one of my favorite topics. Like, and I think actually, if there is a way for us to convey the variety and the depth, the modes of material nature are a very, very powerful way to do that in terms of. Thank you. We'll end here. Oh, sorry.
Hare Krishna. So it's interesting the words, right? Words. I take the view, like, as Vaishnavas, we don't limit ourselves. So we use words how we want to use them. Mm-hmm. If there's an advantage, we do. And I'll give you an example. Sometimes we don't like to call ourselves Hindus because it's got baggage. But other times it's really useful. For example, if you want to get government funding for schools and stuff. So I would say, in the same way for panentheism, I agree with you. It's got baggage because, as you pointed out, there's strands of panentheism which we wouldn't adhere to. But then, in some sense, we do come under that umbrella. But we kind of would like to claim the term. Yes, like for example, going back to Hinduism, I'm going off on strands here. But I've had another thought. In some ways, it's very good that we call ourselves Hindus, because then people identify Hindus with us, and that's kind of, we start to, we are the Hindus, not these people, and it has a positive thing as well. So I reckon we could claim the term panentheism and say, yes, there are many types of panentheism, but we're the best type because we have the form of Krishna. And just Wikipedia, it's interesting, on Wikipedia, let's check now, the verse that Chaitanya Charan quoted is in the Wikipedia article, is like saying Bhagavad Gita has panentheism. So
No, that's true. But I was thinking about the same thing, because I was thinking about, like, you know, we use the term Hinduism like that. But I'll tell you what the difference is. Like Krishna Kshetra Maharaj, he uses this really interesting idea that, you know, instead of the Hinduization of ISKCON, we're looking at the ISKCONization of Hinduism. So very, very interesting perspective. So, but you see, the term Hindu has baggage in the sense of the broad kind of region and you know, kind of traditions, etc. And it's used, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu uses it, it's in, you know, Bhavishya Puran, etc. So it has been used in that sense, and there is a possibility of us claiming it in the way that you say, and the way that Krishna Kshetra Maharaj speaks about ISKCONization. Panentheism is not the same from my standpoint, because it is not a full accurate description of what we're speaking about. So for example, when we speak about the three aspects of the absolute truth, Brahmaiti, Paramatmaiti, Bhagavadanti, Shabdite, so like this reflects a nuance that doesn't exist in panentheism. Panentheism also is not, for us to be able to claim that, that boat has already sailed. Like, this is not a new term. Like, this has been around since the Greek kind of understanding of it. So there are already stakes in the ground around it. So It's just one, and I think we can use it to an advantage. I'm not even saying we shouldn't touch the word. I'm just saying that if we touch it, we have to be really careful with it. We can't just wholesale jump in. And that's where I think that there's a, like if we go around and saying, okay, we're panentheists, that becomes our slogan, that becomes our catchphrase. I think that's dangerous. I think. Okay, I think, it is 9 o'clock now. No, I'm not going to take any money. So, we'll end here. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.